history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And the perspective we gain when we do that is so, so valuable. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Recently, we aired a program focusing on the 75th anniversary of the concentration camps throughout Europe, and we included an excerpt from Alex Kershaw, who has become as prolific and proficient as anyone capturing the micro and macro stories of World War II in print. I promise that you'd be hearing more from this New York Times best-selling author in the future, and with the 76th anniversary of D-Day coming up, I couldn't think of a better time. I think you're really going to enjoy hearing Alex's passion and his perspective. And speaking of D-Day, if you haven't read Alex Kershaw's book, The First Wave, which came out last year, now is the perfect time. It's newly out in paperback. That's The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. But that's just the latest in a string of World War II themed works, and we're going to hear about what he's working on now and when we can expect that. But as I welcome Alex in, I want to start with a really basic question that sometimes I ask World War II veterans, but one that I think a lot of young people ask today and will probably consider even more in the future. So Alex, why does World War II still matter? Why should we take the time to learn about it now?
I just think that, you know, we can take an enormous amount of inspiration, and we often take for granted our freedom. And, you know, that's not a cliche, because an enormous amount of people in this massive global conflict lost their lives, civilians far more than combatants, and that we should never forget what they were fighting for. Now, the irony about World War II is that we needed the Soviets, the Bolsheviks and the communists to defeat fascism. Certainly, that's the case in Europe. But we also had to defeat militant fascism and, you know, very, very violent and aggressive dictatorial regime in the Pacific, the Japanese, and then obviously Hitler. So this was a global conflict that America played a very important role in, but we shouldn't forget it's a global conflict, and the people that benefited most from the victory in that conflict were Western Europeans and anybody that had been oppressed by the Japanese, and obviously Americans, because democracy could continue, and our way of life could continue. America certainly emerged as a massive superpower after World War II. So I think that we have to remember that the world that we live in today was forged out of that global conflict. And we should never forget the sacrifices of the soldiers, men and women that fought in it. And while they're alive, and there's not many left, you know, we should appreciate them and commemorate them and say thank you whenever we can, because it gave an awful lot.
And it really does affect every one of us. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I run into people who they haven't connected with this part of our history, or they don't think it matters, or they don't think there's a connection to their personal life, their personal experience. Is this something that's always been with you, this awareness that something significant happened that affected your life even before you were born? Or was there a moment for you where that kind of clicked in, where it really struck you that, hey, this is something that I need to investigate a little further?
Well, you know, you can tell I'm a Limey. I came to the U.S. in 94 when I was 28 years old. So I've kind of spent almost half my life in the U.S. and then half my life in Europe. So, you know, my grandfather, my mum's dad, died of fatal wounds after a Malta convoy run in 1942. Both my grandfathers served in World War II. One was in the RAF, but the one that died was aboard a couple of very famous, very distinguished British naval destroyers in World War II. And my mum never knew her father. And, you know, my mum's like in her late 70s. And she spent her whole life wondering what it would have been like to have been held by her real father and to have had a father in her life. So, you know, I'm her son, so I grew up in the shadow of her loss too. And us Brits, we're so immersed in the story of World War II. I think it's something that, you know, every British person, certainly when I was growing up, was very much aware of. I remember in the 1970s, for example, my dad driving me and my two sisters from where we lived in the middle of England. We were going to go to France camping, and we drove around the east end of London early in the morning to try and get to the ferry to cross the English Channel. And I remember looking out at this crappy old Ford Cortina station wagon, and I was in the east end of London over 30 years after World War II, and there was like bomb wreckage everywhere. There were craters. The east end of London had not been rebuilt even 30 years later because of the severity of the bombing and the Blitz. So, you know, it was something that was really, I think it's very important today too. Certainly if you look at, for example, the way that the British are getting through the virus, this crisis with the virus today, probably the two people that are most inspirational to the English people today, the British, obviously, too. There's a 100-year-old captain who's just been promoted, who's raised over, I think, $40 million for the National Health Service, the health service in Britain. And then there's, and he's 100 years old, so it's a World War II veteran who's like the star, inspirational figure right now. And then there's another centenarian, a 103-year-old Vera Lynn, who's very iconic. She sang probably the most popular and most moving songs of World War II, White Cliffs of Dover, and then right now she has a really big hit with We'll Meet Again. That was a song that so many people who fought in World War II who are still alive will never forget. So my point is that in Britain, it's a 103-year-old woman and a 100-year-old guy who are still the inspirational figures, are the most inspirational figures for millions of people going through this awful crisis. So, you know, that just shows you how powerful the narrative of World War II and what happened then is still in Britain. You know, we talk about Churchill. It's a foundational story for modern Britain. And I think it should be in America. I think the difference is that hardly any civilians were killed in World War II in the US. So I think there were maybe two or three. You can check me on this, but there was a Japanese balloon bomb that exploded on the West Coast, and I think it may have killed a couple of civilians. But anyway, those are the only civilians that I know of that were killed in that massive global conflict. So for Americans, there was a lot of rationing. There was they had to work very, very hard. Women were empowered. They replaced men in the workplace. But the war was fought 3,500 miles away in one direction, across the Atlantic in Europe, and then even further away in the Pacific. It was a very distant war. It was a war that was not truly understood by the average American civilian because they weren't impacted by it, apart from when, you know, they had to work harder. There was certain rationing, and then the major impact would have been the fact that their loved ones were away. That, you know, there were millions of Americans serving abroad, and that obviously many of them were killed, hundreds of thousands wounded, and we don't know how many psychologically affected for the rest of their lives. But there wasn't the devastation of London and the Blitz. There wasn't the utter devastation that most of Europe suffered. I mean, Europe was a ruin 75 years ago today. It was astonishing. The amount of Americans in senior positions that when they toured the battlefields in Europe, Eisenhower, for example, 75 years ago in May 1945, was utterly astonished by the level of devastation in Eastern Europe and Germany. It was a complete ruin. So I think that is something that is missing from the American experience, and one that is very, very much still that memory, the memory of the destruction, the memory of the civilian suffering of the, I think, at least 18 million European civilians were dead at the end of World War II. That's an awful lot of loss and suffering and tragedy and darkness. And it's just a very, very, very powerful experience still today for all Europeans.
Well, and so many of the American veterans witnessed that and then came back to this country and had that perspective that people here did not have. And I think your books bring that perspective to so many people who didn't live through that time in history. And one of the things I love about your writing, and also in your social media presence, I've really enjoyed watching you reconnect with book subjects, and you celebrate these veterans. And there's so much of a genuine reverence, not a sensationalism, not a false hero worship, but a genuine respect and admiration for the things these people did. And I'm just curious how you zero in on the people you decide to write about. How does that process work for you? Where did that come from? Because I know you didn't set out when you were a kid, say, hey, I'm going to write all these books about World War II and guys most people have never heard of before.
Well, you know, it was kind of a slow process for me because I started off after college. I started working as a journalist. And I remember pretty early on when I was about 24, 25, God, it's like an age kind of makes you feel really old talking about this. But I was very lucky because I got to interview some people who'd lived through the occupation of the Channel Islands, and that's the only part of Britain that was occupied by the Germans. It's, you know, a couple of islands, three or four islands off the coast of Normandy that the Germans, you know, occupied. So we had Brits, you had, you know, British bobbies taking orders from Nazis. So, you know, I went there and interviewed some people that lived through the German occupation, and it was, for me, it was really fascinating to be able to go and sit in someone's kitchen, have a cup of tea and talk about what it was like to actually have been there in World War II. So I was kind of thinking to myself, well, as a journalist or anybody that's interested in the past or even, you know, the present to a large extent, is there any better story than World War II? No, there isn't. I mean, it's the greatest story of our time. And however morally complex it becomes when you really think about the civilians that were killed by industrial warfare, everywhere there was conflict, it's still a pretty much black and white case of the good guys won. So I was like, it was amazing for me to be able to go and actually interview people who'd been in these incredible battles and turning points. So I think the first time I really got to meet World War II veterans and talk to them and sit down and really start talking to them was when I wrote a biography of Robert Capa, who was the famous life photographer. He was, you know, his images are absolutely legendary. He's the guy that took all the fantastic shots of Americans on Omaha Beach. He was the best war photographer of all time. But anyway, I started interviewing journalists and people and other veterans that had been around. I wanted to find out if there was anybody alive that had been in any of his great iconic photographs. So that was pretty cool. And then I came across, when I was researching Capa, I walked along Omaha Beach where, you know, over 900 Americans were killed on D-Day. And it's about 5.5 mile walk. And I walked all the way along the beach from where Capra had taken his famous 11 photographs and visited the graveyard. And then I went to one end of the beach, which was the most deadly spot you could find yourself on June the 6th, 1944. That was Dog Green sector of Omaha Beach. That's where I think over 90% of one infantry company was slaughtered in the first wave. And I was there and I started talking to, this is back in 1999, 2000. I started talking to a guy who had a blue and a gray patch on his shoulder, and he was from the 29th Division. And he said, oh, you know, look down there. And quite a lot of guys from this little town called Bedford in Virginia were killed there. And I started chatting to him. And anyway, I came back and I came back to the US and I started researching Bedford, Virginia, and I discovered that, you know, 19 guys from a community of around about 3,000 had actually been killed in this one stretch of Omaha Beach in the first wave, and that was the highest per capita loss of any American community on Allied community too on D-Day. And I thought to myself, well, you know, this is an enormous story of heroism and sacrifice, but what would it be to actually tell the story of these guys, but also to tell the story of their community? So I tried to write a book which became The Bedford Boys, which cuts between the guys and then the families back at home. So you, even after D-Day, I cut back and forth from Europe back to the small rural community in Virginia. And it was, you know, it was fairly successful and I really enjoyed it. It was a very powerful experience to me. And that was, God, that's a long time ago, almost 20 years ago. And I've been basically trying to find people to talk to ever since. It's been quite a journey, quite an experience.
I don't know about you, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. This has been my experience, and I haven't been doing it quite as long as you. About 15 years I've been interviewing World War II vets. I find that the more I learn about World War II, the more I think I know about World War II, I realize the more I don't know, that the number of potential stories or other side stories you're aware of just continues to grow exponentially the deeper you dive into it. Have you ever felt kind of that overwhelming sense of you could never grasp all of this?
Yeah, well, definitely, yeah. I mean, I'm not much of an expert on the Pacific War, although it fascinates me. I mean, it's a global conflict on a huge scale, over 16 million Americans in the uniforms. So much happened so quickly, on both in the military sense and the scientific sense and the societal sense. You know, so many things changed so very, very, very quickly. Immense steps forward in so many aspects. I mean, you know, to think about it, 1941 at Pearl Harbor, you know, America, I think by just before Pearl Harbor, or early 1941 anyway, I think that the U.S. forces were only a couple of hundred thousand strong. Certainly in 1940, before mobilization under Roosevelt, the Congress had limited the size of the U.S. Army to around about, I think it was 175,000 men. So there were very strict neutrality laws in the late 1930s passed by Congress yet again to stop Americans from fighting in foreign wars, to keep America out of the Second World War. So we Americans were, the U.S. was, and I say we because I feel like I'm half American now, my wife and son are, but we were totally unprepared for this global conflict. So when the shock of Pearl Harbor comes and we finally have to wake up and realize that we can't stay out of this, that, you know, there's, that we've been attacked and we've been attacked mercilessly, that we have to mobilize for a global war, because Germany declared war on us on the 10th of December, 3 days after Pearl Harbor. So now we've got the Japanese to deal with in the Pacific, and they are relentless and they are brutal and they are very, very efficient, and they've bombed the hell out of us in our backyard. And then we have the Nazis. And now if you look at the Nazis in the Wehrmacht and the Nazis in 1940, this is, 1941, these guys are scary, scary dudes. The Europe, all of Europe has fallen in less than 6 or 7 weeks. The democracies in Europe fell from May through June of 1940, very, very fast. The Brits had their backsides kicked out of France. No one had been able to stop them. A very, very violent and sophisticated modern form of warfare that they're practicing with Blitzkrieg. I mean, these are scary enemies. We're really up against it. And in 1941-42, I don't want to get off track here, but if you'd taken anybody that really knew what was going on in America and certainly in Britain, and you'd said to Churchill and Roosevelt privately, what are the odds on us winning this war? Now, I don't think either Churchill or Roosevelt or anybody that really knew what was going on would have bet the bank on Allied victory.
Not at all. And your books have helped remind us of what was really at stake and how significant and at times improbable some of these unforgettable moments really were. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with best-selling World War II author Alex Kershaw. His latest, The First Wave, is now out in paperback, but what can we expect from him next? Find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, in a different feel today as we hear not from a World War II veteran, but from someone who is telling their stories and has been for quite some time. Best-selling World War II author Alex Kershaw is with us. If you haven't read any of his work, there's plenty of it to keep you occupied during this pandemic. Blood and Champagne, about a combat photographer. The Longest Winter, about the Battle of the Bulge. Escape from the Deep, on the submarine USS Tang. You heard him mention The Bedford Boys, about the small town in Virginia that paid a heavier price than any on D-Day. And speaking of D-Day, his book The First Wave, a D-Day masterpiece that came out about a year ago, is available now in paperback. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and you can always find Alex's work at alexkershaw.com. If you're on Twitter, I think you'd really enjoy what he posts. You can feel his sincere admiration and reverence for the veterans of World War II and what they did for the rest of us. And Alex, I understand you're working on a book now about the 3rd Infantry Division. I'm thinking that's a pretty massive undertaking because of how long that division was in combat in World War II and how much ground the 3rd Infantry Division had to cover.
The distance is over 2,500 miles from the deserts of North Africa, Casablanca, all across North Africa, Sicily, Italy, southern France, all the way up the Rhone Valley into the German border, through Germany, and then right to very southernmost part of Germany in the Alps. So 3rd Division, you know, not many people know that they did that, that they were in combat for 635 days. That's longer than any other American division in Europe. It's 100 days longer than any other division that even comes close. Lost the most men. The turnover in men was the highest. They had the largest number of casualties. And interestingly, because they spent so long in combat, they also received the largest number of Medal of Honors given out in World War II. So the 3rd Division had 40 men that received the Medal of Honor, more than half of them posthumously, but that's a hell of an achievement. It's 40, and the Glamour Boys, the 101st Airborne, that, you know, the basis of Ander Brothers, those are the guys that won World War II, aren't they? Fantastic division, but 117 days on the line and just 2 Medal of Honors. So there's no comparison. I mean, in terms of getting the job done, in terms of liberating Europe, in terms of like the tough grinding battle, it was the 3rd ID that gave the most, I believe, of any American infantry division in World War II. So I'm writing about 3 or 4 guys from one regiment, from Audie Murphy's regiment, who fought all the way through to the very end. Audie Murphy's one of them, although he's not the main focus. But right at the end, that there were guys that had won were so decorated that the 3rd Division newspaper, called Frontline, started reporting on Murphy and a couple of other guys as if they were in a sports competition, as if it was a race to get, you know, the most medals. But there were guys in that unit, the 15th Infantry Regiment, that had won every single medal. The first guy in American history, and he's one of my characters. And I'm writing about him this morning, actually. Just before you called me, I'm on Mount Rotundo in November 1943, and the 15th Infantry Regiment with Audie Murphy and others are fighting very, very hard in the mountains, the Apennines in Italy, against the Germans. And they're losing a lot of guys, and they're stalled. They've basically been halted. And there was a guy called Morris Britt who played football for the University of Arkansas. Then he played one season, I think, in the NFL for the Detroit Lions. He was a hell of an athlete. And Morris Britt became a captain of K Company in the 3rd Division. And he became the first American ever, this is astonishing, he became the first American ever to earn every single medal for valor in one war, and that's the Second World War. So he went Bronze Star, Silver Star, BSC, and Medal of Honor, and he was the first American to win all those medals in one single conflict, and that was World War II. He won the Medal of Honor in November 19. His actions, rather I should say, were in November 1943 in Italy, and he was then after being very badly wounded in Anzio, actually losing his arm, he was sent back to the US to recuperate and was a superstar. We've not been forgotten about him now, you know. I mean, unless you're a Detroit football fan or from the University of Arkansas, you know, you don't know this guy's name. But the name, I'll repeat it, Morris Britt, Captain Morris Britt. It was the first American to win every Medal of Valor in any war. So, yeah, I'm writing about him and Murphy and a couple of other guys. There's one, another astonishing guy called Michael Daly. He was 20 years old. Again, he was a junior officer, company commander, and he won the Medal of Honor on the 18th of April, 1945, in the bloody ruins of Nuremberg. He was one of the last guys in the U.S. Army to receive the Medal of Honor in World War II, and barely survived. He was shot through the head, shot through the face, rather, on the 18th of April, 1945, having performed actions that earned him the Medal of Honor. So he was in the same infantry regiment as Murphy. They knew each other in World War II. So it's a kind of ultimate brotherhood I'm writing about, you know, guys that served in the same unit that were the most decorated and saw the most combat and came home and lived to tell the tale. You know, and they were so-called superstars because they had that Medal of Honor around their neck, but the weight of that medal was immense. It was crushing for some of them. You know, they came back and they were utterly traumatized. They were very badly affected by PTSD. They'd been broken in many ways inside, but it was a real ordeal to try and readjust to peacetime, let alone being treated like a saint and a superhero wherever you go, and you're only in your early 20s. I mean, Michael Daly was 20 years old when he received the Medal of Honor, had been in combat since Omaha Beach on June the 6th, 1944. Audie Murphy was, I think he was only 20 years old at the end of the war, 21, Medal of Honor recipient. These are very young people. My son's 22. These guys have been through hell for an awful long time, and they were still younger than my son when they came back from World War II, and then were expected to just get on with it and, you know, act like the poster boys for courage and bravery and do no wrong and go back to a job and work 9 to 5 and be good middle class Americans and put the war behind them and never show anger and remorse or how heartbroken they really were or how destroyed so much of their faith in humanity and their psyche had been by seeing what they did. I'm writing about guys that are fighting like cavemen. That's what Murphy described it as, the fall of 1943 in Italy. They were so tired, so exhausted, so the conditions were so difficult that they really were, it was a battle of savages. It was primeval. It was about which guy's instinct was better than the others. Did you have the gumption? Did you have the basic human instinct to be able to detect the enemy before they detected you, and then could you then kill the enemy before they killed you? Were your ears sharp enough? Was your eyesight good enough? Were your instincts good enough? Could you stay quiet? Could you stay on your feet? Could you stay awake? Could you function in complete survival mode for day after day after day and stay alive? Because all the time people were trying to kill you. So I think that, you know, if you have been through that, and I haven't, thankfully, but quite a few people that I've interviewed over the years have been through that, and that's something that never leaves you, and it's hard to move beyond that. And I think Michael Daly, for example, went back to a reunion of the 3rd Division, went back to his old regiment many years later in Germany, and he said that, you know, that as he got older, as he got into his 70s, the memories got stronger. The memory of what he'd been through when he was just 20 years old, those memories became so much more powerful as he got older. They didn't fade at all. They became more distinct. They were sharper. They were more meaningful when he looked back on his life. And I think that's what I find with several of the veterans that I've spoken to in the last few years, is that the moments they remember are so vivid. They stand out above so much else in their life, you know? So yeah, the memories become more powerful. The emotions become more powerful. They can look back and realize just how important those bonds were to others. They can remember what it did to them. They know that they are a product of that, that in their essence, in their deepest essence of who they are, that was something that was very, very formative. So, yeah, no, I think it's all about what this thing does to human beings. And yet, you know, I think that one of the things that I'm always left with is that, you know, people that were there, if you were liberated Dachau on the 29th of April, if you were there and at the end of the war, if you'd survived Okinawa, if you had come through this and you were there at the end and you came home, that there was nothing that would ever make you feel more proud as a These are moments that shone like beacons in their lives, that were these immense moments of historical importance that people could feel so immensely proud of today and always have. But to be able to say, I was there, I did it, I was part of that, I was there on Omaha Beach, I was there in the Battle of the Bulge, I was there when Dachau was liberated. I stood in that concentration camp 75 years ago, almost to the hour, and I looked at what the Third Reich had done to civilization, and I was a liberator. I brought hope that what I had done was something so extraordinarily monumental and good. That's a great thing to be able to carry with you, even, you know, when you're 95, 97 years old, you know?
Well, and I've always been moved by the juxtaposition, the duality of that there is this pride of accomplishment, there's this satisfaction, especially now that it's being recognized and the people get it and maybe understand a little more, but it's balanced out by that humility of spent a lifetime feeling like I didn't do as much as someone else did. I got to come home, and those guys back there are the real heroes.
This is interesting because, you know, I was asked that question on live TV on June the 6th for the 75th anniversary. I think it was by CBS. I can't remember, MSNBC. Someone was filming veterans in the graveyard at Colville Seminary. Very powerful scenes, you know, 9,000 dead Americans in that one graveyard above Omaha Beach. And someone said precisely that, you know, I fought, I came home, but the real heroes are the ones that are buried here. You know, and that's repeated by many people. And I think Audie Murphy was like one of the first famous World War II veterans that actually said that. He says, you know, devoted his book to the guys who didn't come home, and you hear that all the time. But that really is a kind of like honorable modesty. It's the sort of thing that you would expect someone that was decent and a good guy to say. But the fact is that I will disagree on this one point alone. I have interviewed dozens of people who are superstar heroes that went through so much combat and were just really damn lucky that they lived. They were also heroes. They are also heroes, but they would never call themselves that. That's universal. I think anybody that's been in combat would never call themselves. There's somehow something kind of, I don't know, distasteful about calling yourself a hero. Other people can do that, but you don't call yourself hero when you've been in situations where people that you fought with have died. So yeah, but I would disagree on that one point. I was sitting there thinking, like, well, hang on a second. You know, there are some people that are still alive who, you know, couldn't make the flight to Normandy, didn't get to go to that graveyard, who did remember what it was like to be in the 29th Division, the 1st Division, the 4th Division, who do remember the hedgerows of Normandy and how, you know, they were basically like 1 out of 10 of them were still alive by the end of that summer of 1944 after D-Day. They do remember it. It's probably, they still have nightmares about it. And they are heroes. And they, you know, it's just, I don't know. I think my point is that, yes, the heroes, obviously, they're left behind, but there are also amazing heroes that came back. So I think that's it's a kind of modesty, but we shouldn't forget that amongst us today are superheroes. I mean, that's all you can call them, really. You know.
Amen. And I felt that modesty, that humility, only underscores how heroic and exemplary they really are. Some of the veterans we interview on this show give me a hard time about calling it hometown heroes. It really can make them uncomfortable. But I think you just explained very eloquently why they are heroes to the rest of us and why it's important that we continue to shine a light on what they did so long ago. It's break time again, but there's more to come with best-selling World War II author Alex Kershaw. I guess we should find out when that book about the 3rd Infantry Division is coming out, right? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honor honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a little different conversation today. Instead of hearing from a World War II veteran, we've been visiting with a guy who has spent more than half his life writing about World War II veterans. Before we dive back in with author Alex Kershaw, I want to share a heads up on something happening in the week ahead that you can be a part of, and it's really easy to do. If you're a regular Hometown Heroes listener, or really for that matter, if you're a football fan, I'm sure you remember Donnie Edwards, the former Pro Bowl linebacker. Like me, like Alex, Donnie is the grandson of a World War II veteran who inspired him greatly. And Donnie's nonprofit, the Best Defense Foundation, has done great work with veterans, often flying them back to the battlefields where they risked their lives so long ago. If not for this coronavirus pandemic, Donnie would have been in Normandy with a group of D-Day heroes for the 76th anniversary. Since that is not possible, the Best Defense Foundation is organizing a virtual D-Day walk. It's a 5K, and there's a reason for that distance. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com for a link to sign up and learn more about that virtual D-Day walk. Alex Kershaw has chronicled so much World War II history in print. And when we left off, he was sharing about the project he's working on now, a book about Audie Murphy and his highly decorated counterparts in the 3rd Infantry Division. And I guess we're going to have to wait a little over a year to read that, Alex. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we're heading for October of next year. Yeah, it's called Against All Odds because the odds of surviving what they did were probably the slimmest for any Americans in combat in World War II. If you were alive at the end of what the 3rd Division went through and you were still fighting, it was a miracle. I think from Company B, that's 200 guys that Audie Murphy was with in North Africa. I think it was only Murphy and one other guy that was still in Company B at the end of the war. Murphy had been taken off the front line because he'd received the Medal of Honor and they didn't want Medal of Honor recipients to be killed. They wanted them to go back and be propaganda figures for war bonds, etc. So there's only one guy in that infantry company that wasn't killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. So yeah, if you got to the end of that long, long slog, it was against all odds. It was something that was not rational to expect, and they didn't expect it, you know. During the research, I've been to where I was back in January before the virus crisis hit. I was on the beach in Saint-Tropez, near Saint-Tropez, where Audie Murphy came ashore on the 15th of August 1944. And just inland, about a mile inland, I went to a vineyard where he won the DSC and where he lost his very best friend. And then I went to the graveyard where Americans are buried for that campaign in Provence at Draguignan. It's a really beautiful graveyard. And I went to the grave of Lackey Tipton, who was the guy that was killed on the 15th of August. Murphy held him in his arms. He was his best friend, and he lost him that day. So anyway, the point I'm making is I've been to places in Italy. I went to where Murphy came ashore, the very beach. I stood right on the sands and then followed him inland. And I was actually just on the border of Germany in Holzwehr, where Murphy did win the Medal of Honor, and that was in January of 1945. And during the research, I've stood in these different places. I've been, and the last time I was there in Europe, I was in Nuremberg, and then I went to Holzwehr, and I stood above on a hillside in Siegelsheim, where the 3rd ID, 4 guys from the 3rd ID received the Medal of Honor. And it was, you can look down on the valley, you know, skirting the Rhine. You can see the black forest in the distance, and you think to yourself, these guys have come 2,000 miles to get here. And you look around, you go, like, every single river, every single street corner sometimes, every single village, every single hillside, every town, every field, every gateway, sometimes every yard, they could have been killed. And it's just, you just think, oh, my God, we forget that these guys were on the attack. They had to move forward to finish the war. You had to get to Berlin or Munich, or you had to get to the end of the end. You had to, you know, kill the enemy in their home. And that meant you had to continually advance if you're an American, if you're an Allied soldier. You were on the attack, and that's different to being on the defense. You actually had to get out of your foxhole sometimes every day and move into the enemy fire. You had to put your neck on the line almost every day to get the job done. So someone had to die. Someone had to take that responsibility. Someone had to attack and lead and put all on the line every day to win. And that's the thing that is an immensity of courage and something that is very hard to get your head around, especially when you go and stand where they have to do it. And because it's not academic then, it's not distant. You're standing where they bled. You look around and you go, oh my God, how did they do it? For example, on Omaha Beach, I take people across Omaha Beach. I follow in the footsteps of the Bedford Boys. I've done it on June the 6th most years, and hopefully next year when this is all over, I'm going to take a group with the National World War II Memorial, and we're going to go at 6:30 hour on D-Day, and we'll stand at the waterline at the very moment when the Bedford Boys landed, when those guys came ashore on the first wave, and we'll cross the beach in almost real time, so you can do it in about 30 minutes, and that's about how long it took the first survivors, very few of them, to get across that bloody beach. When you go and you cross that beach around 6:30 in the morning on June the 6th, and you realize that almost everybody was killed, and the sacrifice and the suffering and but the impact of that, it's not just a history book. It's about who we really are. It goes deep into the soul of who we are, you know? We can't know ourselves unless we know our history, and you can't really know yourself if you're, and I don't mean this in the wrong way, I don't think you can really know yourself as a proud American that loves their country unless you understand what happened on places like Omaha Beach, what happened in Anzio, what happened in parts of the world in World War II.
I'm thinking about the people listening, and you've got folks who maybe they still have a living World War II veteran in their family, or maybe that veteran's been gone for years and they've never learned that much about it. What would be your advice for people in either one of those situations? What can they do about it if they want to understand the kind of things you just talked about?
Well, I think that you can understand a lot from reading the memoirs of the people who were there, and there are very good accounts. I try and do my best. I try and bring the voice of the veterans to life as much as I can, but there are really good books out there that you can read, which are actually written by the veterans themselves. I mean, I think that probably one of the best accounts of what it was really like to be a foot soldier in World War II is Audie Murphy's, you know, book To Hell and Back. Now, I think that came out in late 1940s. I should know. I'm researching his life right now. But, you know, start with some of the actual memoirs of some of the veterans. And if you look carefully and closely, you can come across really, really well-written ones. You know, The Pacific has, I think that the HBO series, The Pacific, was based on three different memoirs. I think it's three different memoirs, all of them beautifully written, very powerful, literature, really high art. So I would always say, if your dad was in the, you know, served in the Mediterranean theater, was in Sicily or Italy, then read Murphy to start off with, and then browse around a little bit. But go to the memoirs of the people who fought that were there, and that's when if you get a good one, you'll get a real feel for kind of what it was like, you know. I mean, there's a lot that they was taken out, but I mean, Murphy's memoir, so close to the war in the late 40s, was really close to the bone. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that it's like, wow, it's about as real as you can get, you know. That would be my advice. And then, you know, general histories, and then oral histories. I know that the World War II Museum in New Orleans have a really good oral history collection that's now digitized, I think, and available to the public. So if you can search that. You know, one of the great things, Imperial War Museum in London is a fantastic resource. And one of the really great things is that we've been very good in Britain and in the US and in the other allied nations. I think that the Russians have done a very good job too. I hope they have. I don't know much about that. But anyway, certainly among the victors of World War II, there's been a huge amount of commemoration and a lot of great oral history that's been done. And we should be very thankful to the veterans for agreeing to do that, but also to all the people like you and others that try and keep these memories alive, aflame, and that have spent time interviewing people. And so we've got this golden, like no other war in history, no other period of time in history do we have so much raw material, raw data to mine for, you know, hopefully centuries to come. There's so much stuff that we've not even looked at, that, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of oral history with veterans that we've not even looked at yet, that great, you know, people have been, you know, whether it's the grandson recording his grandfather, or someone like me, or the Library of Congress, or people like yourself, or as long as their voices have been recorded, we're going to have a treasure trove for the rest of the time, I think.
Sounds like you're not planning on stopping these World War II history pursuits anytime soon.
I don't know. I think about writing about some other period or something else, and I'm like, well, it's just not. It's like you know, being a sports reporter for the NBA, and you get to go to all the good games, and then someone says, oh, go and cover softball, a high school softball. You know, it's like, I'm like, no, I want my seat at the ringside. Thank you. That's where the big game is. You know, I think there's different ways to look at World War II. It's always different angles, and I think that I've become very interested in a female angle on World War II recently. I've been researching actually speaking to a nurse that was on a ship that was hit by a kamikaze. I actually spoke to her a couple of weeks ago, and just this idea that there were women that are when you talk about World War II, we kind of think like, oh, it's just all guys, you know, but there are actually women alive today who are combat veterans from World War II. Yes, they were nurses, but they were in combat. They had kamikaze planes squealing down at them every 2 or 3 hours for weeks on end, 75 years ago in World War II. That's a combat veteran. You know, when you are when you're holding the hand of some 19-year-old that's been maimed beyond recognition or been burnt very, very badly in a vicious battle in Okinawa 75 years ago, you know, something over 40,000 American casualties, over something like almost 20 killed, having to root out Japanese from one hole in the ground in a singed, godforsaken island in the middle of the Pacific after a nurse holding that kid's hand as he dies, because a lot of them did, and you're working 12-hour shifts, 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night, and you go back on 12 hours later, and you do that week after week after week. You're overworked, you're really stressed, just like people in hospitals today. It's the same kind of frontline experience in some ways. But yeah, and then you're being attacked, and you've got a suicide bomber in a Japanese Zero plane heading for your cross on your boat or your stack, and you're trying to save lives, and you're being attacked and shot at, and then suddenly the suicide bomber hits your boat, and 6 of your fellow nurses are killed right in front of you. You're a combat veteran, and you're a female, and you're not recognized when you came home, and you're not given any award for valor. You don't even get a Purple Heart, although you were badly hit, and you did your part, and you were an American female that was in a war that not only tried to heal and bring some kind of comfort to terrible suffering, you actually were in the crosshairs of a suicide bomber, a suicide plane. It's amazing, you know? So I think that often the female perspective of World War II has been forgotten and maybe deliberately downplayed in some cases, but certainly needs to be salvaged. We need to really go back and look at the level of sacrifice and what was done by women in America to help us to that final victory.
There are so many aspects worth exploring. As much as there has been written and recorded, there are so many stories still that haven't been told. And I know we're running short on time, but on behalf of all the veterans and their families and the rest of the folks listening today, I just want to thank you for the work you do, for the way you sincerely honor those veterans' legacies. I know your grandfather, that grandfather you never got to meet, is incredibly proud of the way that you have honored that sacrifice that he and so many others made. Is there anything else you want to share with us today?
Yeah, and thank you for everything you do. You know, it makes a big difference. Thank you. You said earlier on, which is a very interesting comment that you made, which was that, you know, they've been telling us for years, people like you and me that interview World War II veterans, they've been saying for years there's hardly anybody left. They're all going to be dead. They're all going to be dead. Well, you know, I started interviewing World War II veterans in my 20s, 30 years ago, and anybody that's legally supposed to be qualified for combat in World War II is like 92 now, I think. That's the youngest you could be in seeing combat in World War II. So we are talking about people that are really, really, really old, you know? And I think there's probably maybe less than 300,000 left of World War II veterans in the US, which is really extraordinary when you think about it. But here's my point, that while they're still alive, their hearts are still beating. There's still life there. And until, so the point is that time is even more precious now. When you see the sands disappearing in the egg timer, we're right at the end of that now, you know, and it's almost like everything starts to speed up, you know, so we really are working against the clock. Time is really sadly running out. But now more than ever, while there's still just a few people alive and while we're literally down to the last few years, like 3 or 4 or 5 years maybe, now more than ever, people do not lose their minds even if they're 100 years old. They can be extremely sharp and they can have fantastic memories. And I find that sometimes, you know, in the recent weeks, I've been calling veterans and talking to them, and I've been astonished how sharp some people are. I mean, they're sharper than me. I mean, I talked to a guy, and I won't go on too long, I talked to a guy called Dan Doherty. He was a liberator of Dachau, C Company, 157th Infantry Regiment, 45th Division. And he was in Dachau the day it was liberated. And I talked to him, he's 97, and he's like, he's sharper than me. I'm thinking, oh my God, what's that? I'm like, I'm having to struggle to keep up with it because he's a super smart guy anyway. And he's not lost anything, you know. He's still sharp as a button. And so, you know, they're worth talking to. Still worth talking to, more than ever.
Amen. And I'm pretty sure everybody listening right now is probably in agreement with that. Alex Kershaw, thanks so much. And some of you may be wishing, like I am, that we had some more time to dive into some of the fascinating characters that Alex has written about. If you haven't read any of his books, your library has them. You can order them online. He's at alexkershaw.com. And again, I've got that linked for you, of course, at hometownheroesradio.com. And don't take those final words from Alex lightly. If you still have World War II veterans in your family or in your circle of friends, there's no better time than now to ask them a few questions about what they were dealing with all those years ago, and you never know where that journey is going to take you, but I do know you will not regret it. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.